Welcome to The Exploding Typewriter. This is Pulp Writers on Writing Pulp. I'm your host, Perry Constantine. And this is going to be our inaugural episode on this podcast about pulp writers and pulp creators and how they do what they do, why they do what they do, and how you could potentially do it yourself if you're interested. And when we're talking about pulp fiction, the first thing I usually get asked when I tell people I write pulp is, what is pulp? And so to answer that question, I figured there's no better person to have on the show than the guy who came up with the definition of new pulp, and that is publisher of Pro Se Press and writer of many things. The guy is so busy, he makes me dizzy just by looking at him. And that is Tommy Hancock. Tommy, how you doing today?
I'm doing great, Perry. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Okay, now you're the one who first came up with the definition of new pulp, although you're the first to admit that new pulp started even before you came along. Can you talk a little bit about why you decided to come up with the term for that?
Well, let's clarify a little bit. I mean, I love, you know, when people say, wow, you did that. But I didn't really come up with the definition. What I did was when I got into writing pulp, I've always written pulp, but when I actually got into the new pulp field, there was a lot of the term being thrown around, you know, pulp this, pulp that, new pulp, neo-pulp, whatever. And I guess I sort of spearheaded this group of about 30 to 40 writers or so. And I guess I organized it and said, hey, you know, if we're all doing the same thing, even though we're different companies and we're independent writers and that sort of thing, why not figure out what we're writing? Because so many different people had an opinion of what pulp was. And so what we did is we sat down and we said, okay, let's do a couple of things. First off, what are we defining? Are we defining pulp? Are we defining new pulp? Are we defining classic pulp? And the definition we came up with has been used interchangeably for pulp and new pulp. So I didn't really come up with it, but I did sort of, I guess, organize the group that did. And the definition we came up with focused on pulp being fast-paced, plot-oriented storytelling with larger-than-life characters, antagonists and protagonists. I even more specify that as good and evil, but that's just a preference. Makes good use of the language, including interesting turns of phrase. And that's just a real basic overview. So what we did is we kind of sort of came up with this definition. And the instant – it was really funny because when we came up with it, one of the reasons that I decided to come up with it was there was just so much argument in the community.
Right, right.
And being naive, I thought a definition might settle some of that. Mm-hmm. Since then, I there are probably a few pulp writers and pulp collectors who have my face on their dartboards because – yeah, because I came up with this definition. And so even though I do believe, and that is the definition that we use at Pro Se to judge if a story is pulp. Mm-hmm. However, personally, I have come to believe more of the opinion that I credit to Derek Ferguson. Derek Ferguson, you know Derek. He's a new pulp writer. Derek and I have been friends via the internet and personally forever, and way back in the days of Artifice Comics, actually, when we were both writing for them,
right.
We got into a discussion because I was becoming known as sort of the pulp guy even then, and we got into a discussion about what pulp was, and Derek said it this way. He used the analogy or the story of the Supreme Court justice who was asked what pornography was, mm-hmm. and Derek said – or the justice, excuse me, said that I don't know what pornography is, but I know it when I see it.
Right, right.
And that's the way I look at pulp. I can't look at – I can't tell you, even though I think the definition that we came up with is a good guideline for writers and for publishers and we use it, I'm more comfortable these days with saying when I see a pulp story, I know it's a pulp story.
Right, right. Yeah, that's I'd agree with that completely. I don't know how to define it, but I know it when I see it. And Yeah, that's a really good definition. It's hard to beat that. I wanted to throw at you some other ones that I've heard. Like, this is from Chuck Wendig's blog, and he had a really interesting take on it. So I think you've read this, because I think you're one of the people who commented on the blog entry. But anyway, what he wrote was, "New Pulp cares not for your mortal genres. I've long admired writers who bend genres to their whims instead of being bent to the strictures of genre. A guy like Joe Lansdale is all over the map in terms of what he writes. Everything from crime thrillers to sci-fi to satire to Southern Gothic to weird westerns to whatever the hell wants to come out of his head at any given moment. Sometimes this turbid genre muddiness is found in a single book. Look at Stephen King's Gunslinger series. What is that? Horror? A little. Fantasy? A little. Western? A little. It's its own thing, that series. You might describe it using one of my favorite non-words, unpin-downable. A new pulp writer doesn't know what to call himself. He can't say, I'm a thriller writer or I write crime. He just writes. Whatever crazy-ass shit enters his head goes to the page one way or another."
Okay, I get that entire definition and I like it, but I'm going to turn it on its ear a little bit.
Okay.
I think pulp is completely dependent on genre. Now, having said that, the new pulp is pushing the boundaries, or as he said, breaking the strictures of genre. And I agree with that.
Right.
But pulp is completely bound in genre. There is no story that is a pulp story. Pulp is not a genre.
Right.
Pulp is a style, and we can talk more about that in a minute. But if you're writing a story about a guy who goes into a bar and he robs the bar and he leaves and the mafia men in the bar are coming after him and it's the story of how he escapes and then turns and defends himself, that's a crime story.
Right.
Depending on how it's written, that's a noir story. Depending on the style it's written in, it's also a pulp story.
Right.
You can't divorce pulp from genre, and it's not its own genre. Now, what he's saying basically is that it's not restricted by genre, and in no way is new pulp restricted by genre. Not at all.
Right, absolutely.
The mashup is the baby of new pulp.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've seen it, you know, in weird westerns. We've seen it in sci-fi romance. We've seen it in all sorts of places. That mashing genres together is what's going on,
right?
In pulp, and that's what we want. But yeah, so that I agree mostly with a little bit of disagreement.
Mm-hmm. It kind of illustrates the debate that goes on, and how I think the key word to pick out of there, I think, is unpin-downable, because that seems to go hand in hand with people trying to define new pulp.
I agree, and it even goes hand in hand. And I'll get people who will listen to this that will complain at me because you keep going back to classic pulp. But you can't talk about new pulp, especially defining it, without looking at its roots. New pulp would not exist if in 1896 the first pulp magazine wasn't published. It just wouldn't. It wouldn't exist. So you have to look back at that. And I think the only way people pin down classic pulp is the fact that it was printed on pulp paper.
Right.
You had pulp magazines and you had slick magazines. And if you weren't a slick magazine, you were a pulp magazine. Therefore, you can call classic pulp, all the classic pulps people collect are pulps. But when you look beyond that, you look at how they were written. They were all written with, you know, often horrendous deadlines. They were written quickly. They were written. Street and Smith and other places used, you know, a plot line that you had to get the hero in. You had to fight the villain. You had to save the girl, whatever it was. And they were written in this formulaic way almost.
Right.
And so you can't look at any.
There was a very blue-collar ethos to it.
Yeah, and I can't think of the name of the author. I'm going to wheel across my room and see if I can find the book. The name of the book is Hard Boiled, and it's a study that was written by a female professor, and I'm not laying my eyes on it right now.
Oh, yeah. I wrote a paper on the paper I wrote about Black Pulp referenced that book.
Yes, and she takes, and it's one of the best studies ever on the development of early 20th century fiction, and it focuses largely on pulp because that's where it developed, and it's very blue collar. These were the guys who were coming home from the factories, and they were going home to lives that they overall really didn't want, that they were never going to get beyond. You had two periods of people. You had the guys who came out of World War I who never would recapture the glory they thought they had then, or never recovered from the war, who were now stuck in these jobs, and the blue collar population grew and grew and grew. Then you had people, you had kids coming up who, you know, would get 3 pennies or a nickel or a dime for sweeping the sidewalk, and they'd walk up and what would be on the news kiosk with the Shadow or Doc Savage or Phantom Detective, and they'd throw their dimes down. But it wasn't the people in the penthouses reading this stuff. They were, but where this was really selling, where this took off, was very much blue collar.
Exactly, yeah. And especially when it comes to kids, like, it was to kids back then what when I was growing up, and I imagine when you were growing up too, what comic books were for us.
No, very much so. Very much so. You know, and it's funny you say that, because I always tell people I'm the odd kid, because don't get me wrong, I collected comic books, but I was also, the very first book I remember ever buying was a Doc Savage omnibus on a spinner rack at Kmart.
They were back in reprints at that time when you were coming of age.
Right. They were in the thick omnibuses that had the Bama covers from the 60s. But I went and I picked it up off the spinner rack, and it was a comic book spinner rack, but it was full of books, and and that's the first book I ever actually paid my own money for. So I was into pulps and old time radio and comic books. I was into stuff. It's so funny to go to conventions these days and hear kids today. I mean, and by kids I mean anywhere from 13 to 23 talk about stuff now that when I was that age, nobody else knew about but me, or at least I didn't think anybody did.
Right.
Because I was the kid sneaking away at night. You know, when my mom would tell me to go to bed, I'd have my grandpa's old radio under my bed, and I'd be listening. There was a college station that played the old-time radio shows.
Wow.
So I'd listen to Fibber McGee and Molly, and I'd listen to Nightbeat, and I'd listen to The Shadow. The pulp magazines were the comic books, along with movie serials. Mm-hmm. The pulp magazines were that really cheap entertainment, because, you know, you can't even imagine, you know, what do you go? You go into Walmart and you spend 50 cents. What are you going to get? On a special, you might get a candy bar, and that's going to be out of date.
Right, right.
Back then, you wouldn't even spend 50 cents to go to a movie, which was a news feature, a cartoon, trailers, and possibly a serial, and possibly two movies, and then go buy a pulp magazine, you wouldn't spend 50 cents.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it was the comic books.
Yeah. You mentioned the roots of pulp. So let's do a little bit of a history lesson for people who may not know much about the history of pulp.
Okay. Well, I am not the biggest expert in it, and I will say that up front. You could have people like Will Murray and Matt Mooring and Ed Hulse and other people on to give a more detailed history. Mine's just kind of a thumbnail. But essentially, in the late 19th century, publishers began printing these magazines on this cheap yellow coarse paper. And if you pick up a pulp magazine today, it's funny because I take some classic pulps with me when I do presentations, and I show them to people, and they talk about how brittle and yellow it is. And I look at them, and it's funny because it is brittle and yellow because it's old, but it was fairly coarse and brittle and yellow when it was first printed.
Right, right.
Maybe not so much brittle, but it was a coarse, rough paper.
Right.
And what publishers started doing is they would take this pulp paper, this cheap paper, and they would pay authors next to nothing to write these stories. And when pulps really exploded, you know, during the Depression, you had writers or men who wanted to be writers, who wanted to eat, were writing things for next to nothing. I mean, you know, and turning out stories continually.
Right. Basically chained to their desk.
Yeah. You know, you talk about Walter Gibson.
Mm-hmm.
Walter Gibson, who essentially created the Shadow, as we know him in the pulp magazines, was turning out, you know, two novels a month,
mm-hmm.
two full-length pulp novels a month. Lester Dent was prolific, the guy who essentially created Doc Savage. And I say essentially because both of those characters were sort of the seeds were given to them, but they really are the people who put the meat on those characters' bones.
Right. They define the characters.
Right. And then you talk, you know, and I get so tickled. I go to, and as a matter of fact, I'm doing one this weekend, writer's conference. Now, conventions are a little different. Conventions, there's usually a like mind or two in the audience. And when mm-hmm. I say, because I always give a little quiz. I always say, you know, here, and this is how I gauge my audience. I say, okay, I'm going to ask you about a character and you're going to tell me who it is. First name's Clark. He was raised to be the defender of humanity. He was the peak of, almost the peak of perfection in every way, and he had a fortress of solitude. Who is it? Well, of course, everybody says Superman.
Right, right.
But it wasn't. It was Doc Savage.
Yeah.
First, anyway, it was Doc Savage. And I usually end it with, and he's called the Man of, well, everybody goes, the Man of Steel, it's Superman. No, it's the Man of Bronze, Doc Savage. And you had these people who created these awesome characters. But then you also had, because it gets funny, when I go to these writers' conferences, people still to this day look down on pulp as something sleazy, something cheap as far as the style goes. And,
right.
And we're okay with, at least I'm personally okay with a little bit of that. When somebody does that, when there's that opinion out there, it gives me a little bit of stylistic freedom to go places that mm-hmm. literary writers might not go.
Right, right.
But then I start talking about the people who wrote pulp. You'd be amazed at how many people argue with me when I say that Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler wrote pulp.
Oh, they absolutely did.
When you talk about Louis L'Amour.
Harlan Ellison.
Louis L'Amour, Harlan Ellison, Louis L'Amour, Robert Heinlein, Isaac Asimov.
Yeah.
You start talking about these literary names. I actually had a lady stand up in a conference not too long ago and proceed to try to argue with me for 20 minutes that there is no way that Forrest Sprague de Camp and Robert Heinlein would have lowered themselves to work in pulp magazines.
They had nothing to lower. They had to up themselves first before they could lower themselves.
That's exactly what I said. I said, ma'am, I said, that's where they started. If that's the bottom, that's where it began.
Yeah.
And I've even had arguments with people that, and it can be argued. Some people will argue that he was not technically a pulp writer, but I believe he was. I think most people would tell you he was. I have people that argue with me that Edgar Rice Burroughs doesn't qualify.
No, he qualifies. I mean, that was how he got his start. Like, he saw these things and he said, I can do this.
He can do this. And he did it in All Story yeah. Weekly, if my memory is correct. So, yeah, you had, you know, but that's the history. And there was this huge boom. There was this huge boom in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, particularly. Mm-hmm. And then it almost... It's really funny because you look at the period, 1896 to about 1954. Mm-hmm. So there's about 60 years, 58, 60 years. It spikes and it drops and it vanishes.
Right.
You know, pulp just goes away. And it went away for a few reasons. Comic books was one. TV was one. Comic books being portable was one. You know, mm-hmm. it was much easier for a soldier in World War II to slide a Shazam Captain Marvel comic book in his back pocket than it was to roll up a Doc Savage.
Right, right.
Pulp magazine and put it in his back pocket.
They also had less pages, so probably a little bit cheaper to print.
I would guess. Well, I don't know, because remember, pulp was really cheap.
Right,
but
right.
But costs did go up, so that may be a possibility as well. But two things happened. One, comic books grew in huge popularity, so much so that the Doc Savage comic that came out in the 40s and such, comic books had such a control over the market at that point that they actually put Doc Savage in a super suit
mm-hmm.
and gave him a jewel that let him have powers.
I remember hearing about this stuff.
Yeah, and it's the corniest. Even if you didn't know who Doc Savage was, mm-hmm. you wouldn't have – like this character.
Didn't they turn the Shadow into a cyborg at one point too, or something like that?
Now that was in the 80s.
Okay.
So you have this sudden rise and this sudden fall. And here's the great thing about pulp. even though the medium essentially died out and it was replaced mm-hmm. with paperbacks and other things, and you have people today, and I think they're right, people today compare e-books to the pulp of the, you know, it's right. the pulp of the era because it's cheap to do. The style didn't die away. You had these writers who went on to do other things. I mean, Louis L'Amour, you can't go into a used or a new bookstore and not see a shelves full of Louis L'Amour. Mm-hmm. Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, Heinlein, all those people. But even the lesser writers went on to other things. They went on to write radio shows. They went on to write mm-hmm. TV. They went on to write movies. So the style that was created in pulp was perfect for episodic TV.
Oh, it yeah.
Deal. You packed, just like you packed a whole ton of action into 8 pages, 10 pages, 20 pages, whatever, you packed a whole ton of action into 30 minutes. So mm-hmm. that style continued on. Then you throw in the fact that pretty much, I can't pinpoint it to a year, but pretty much right after the pulps faded away, fans began writing pulp stories.
Mm-hmm.
And they began exchanging them in mail and eventually mimeographs and fanzines, Howard Hopkins, Golden Perils fanzine, all of that stuff. That started almost immediately because people wanted to read this stuff. They wanted the heroes to continue and they wanted the style to continue. So you had these fanzines pop up. You had a lot of these writers go into comic books and all of this. And then you had, you know, comic book companies, Stan Lee, the worst criminal of all in this, so to speak, liberally borrowing from the pulps. Most people don't know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, Stan Lee, of course, the concept for Spider-Man, Stan's been interviewed as saying that was inspired by the Spider pulp character.
Mm-hmm.
There's even a more blatant lift that he did from the Spider magazine because the Spider at one point in the pulps fights the invincible Iron Man.
Mm-hmm.
And the figure in the pulp looks extremely similar to Tony Stark's first costume.
Right, you know, right.
The big boiler stove looking thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so you had all these comic people were borrowing, and so it gets passed down generation to generation, and I think a big spike in it happens in 1980-81, when these two fairly well-known but still considered sort of kind of upstart directors decide they want to make a Doc Savage movie.
Right.
So they take this concept, these two guys take this concept around, and nobody wants to hear about Doc Savage. Why? Because 5 years earlier, the often debated but usually considered horrible Ron Ely Doc Savage George Pal movie had come out. And I don't know if you've ever seen it, but
no, I haven't. It came out that late, though. I thought it came out much earlier.
No, it was in 75, or give or take. Oh, okay. And there's if you really want a hoot, there is a re-edited version of that movie somewhere online where a guy took the whole movie, re-edited it, and put in different music because they made a decision, I think, toward the end of putting it together. And my facts may be off a little bit. But they soundtracked this whole thing with John Philip Sousa music.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just awful. The soundtrack just horribly affected the movie. They put the cartoon twinkle on Ron Ely's teeth whenever Doc smiled, that sort of thing.
Oh, God.
But they had the basic concept because this guy who did this re-edit turned it into a decent movie. But anyway, so these two directors in 80-81 or 79-80 are walking this movie around and nobody wants it. Doc Savage.
Right.
Nobody's interested in it. So they take it back and they rewrite it and they tweak it and they take out the team and they build this character into one guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Indiana Jones.
Yeah, yeah. And even more with the pulp connection, Jim Steranko, when he was doing concept art, he based it entirely on Doc Savage.
Well, and that had a lot to do with the fact that the original plan was that Spielberg and Lucas wanted to do was a Doc Savage movie.
Exactly.
But what do we get? We get what at the time people think is a largely original character, and Indy is. I mean, But if you're into the serials and all of that, you recognize the influence.
Right. And I think Ron Fortier talked on Better in the Dark about how it's actually paced like a serial, where like every 15 minutes there's like a cliffhanger thing.
Well, and I want to say the timing is even closer than that. But Ron's right. It is. It's pace that every 10 to 15 minutes there is an event. There is something that happens that puts the hero in danger, or whoever the focus is on. There's a 15 minute period where it's more about can't think of her name, Ravenwood. But yeah,
Marilyn.
That the central character is in danger. Yeah, yeah, that's right. But this was Pulp in 1981 that was a huge hit and harkened back to the serials of the old days, but really put Pulp back on the map. So much so that shows like Tales of the Gold Monkey came out and other things. And one of my favorite benefits, and I may have people who no longer read me when I say this. So you know, one of my favorite side benefits of Raiders of the Lost Ark is the Tom Selleck movie, High Road to China. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
No, I've never even heard of that.
Oh, it's fantastic. Now, it's lower budget, and it's not Raiders of the Lost Ark by any stretch of the imagination. But it was a movie I saw, and he plays an adventuring aviator.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fantastic. It is definitely a Pulp movie. So you have these high points after 1954, 55. You have these high points of Pulp, and another one pops up, even though it's comic related. Another one pops up in the very early 90s with a different movie. Started with a comic book, made its way into a movie, and made a splash that affected a lot of people. Because if you ask writers today, especially younger writers, you know, well, what influenced you to want to write new Pulp, one of the movies they'll list typically is The Rocketeer.
Yeah. I remember seeing that in the theater when it came out. That was amazing.
Yeah, and a lot of people, there are a handful of writers out there who don't even know it was a comic book. So, you know, they're not really doing their research. But
right.
It was a comic that actually, in a very crafty way, featured Doc, Monk, and Ham, which they couldn't do in the movie, so they stuck in Howard Hughes. There are these points that the style continues. Now, you mentioned earlier, and you're right. I am in no way in the belief that I, in 2010, in this group of 30, 40 writers, started New Pulp. Because, you know, you mentioned Ron Fortier. Ron and Airship 27 had been around since 2006. You have people like Wildcat Books. But I'm gonna pinpoint for you where I think New Pulp started in its modern incarnation. And I'll have people who argue with me.
Okay.
Because it didn't start necessarily immediately in prose. It actually started in comic books, and that has to do with Moonstone Books.
Mm-hmm.
Moonstone started putting out Phantom Comics. They started putting out Kolchak. They put out some radio-themed comics, Pat Novak for Hire, Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar, in 95 starting out, 1995.
Oh, it was that far back. Wow.
It's that far back, yeah. If you want to pinpoint the beginning of New Pulp, as far as I'm concerned, because we call it a renaissance, we call it a revolution, it's been going on for about 20 years.
Right, right.
Moonstone really paved the way. Then Wildcat, Ron Hanna showed up and brought in people like Ron Fortier and others. And then Ron went off on his own and did Airship. And then, you know, I sort of lucked into what I'm doing with Pro Se and was able to become a partner in the company and pushed off into the new Pulp field in 2010. But you're looking at something that in a lot of ways has been building since 1955, but also really in this incarnation has been building since 1995 and has had a huge, huge boost in the last 5 to 7 years.
Thanks because of the internet and ebook technology and print on demand, which makes it a lot easier to get these books out cheaply and affordably and make some attractive prices for customers and makes it easy for the creators to get them out. Because while a big publishing house may not think it's cost effective to put out a book for a cheap price that will only sell X amount of copies, your small press companies, they've got no problem doing that.
Well, and it's what I said earlier. The internet, the technology, it's really funny to say this, but all the progress forward has allowed publishing to go backward in the
right,
sense.
You're right.
Yeah. In the sense that it is affordable for people to get into it. It is affordable for people individually even to get into it and be self-published, which is a whole other topic and show. But it's affordable again. And it's not just affordable to produce it. It's affordable to purchase it.
Right.
Through ebooks or through print on demand, you know, it's just instantly affordable again. So we've to go forward, we've gone back. And the cool thing about the not just New Pulp, but about the technological progress is the complete and utter destruction that it's causing in the traditional publishing field.
Yeah, there are no more gatekeepers. The doors are wide open now.
Yeah, and there's no, you know, you don't have to have an agent. You don't have to make your bone, so to speak. Now, there are some disadvantages. A lot of people aren't paying big advances anymore, unless they're in the bigger houses. You know, I'll just tell you up front, and I'm honest with this with everybody. You know this. You know, even though I'm one of the largest small presses, I'm a small press. We produce a ton of books. We pay in royalty.
Exactly.
I'm not offering anybody a penny a word, or I'm not offering anybody $1,000 or $100 advance. There are companies out there who pay $20 for a story or $100 for a novel, and they pay no royalty, or they pay 5%, or they pay 15. We all have our scales, is what I'm getting at. But the fact that, you know, just 15, 20 years ago, even maybe not that long ago, that there was this titanium ceiling for writers, that if you couldn't get through it, you were never going to be published. That's gone.
And it wasn't always a matter of your writing's not being good enough. It was just a matter of your writing is not marketable enough to a wide enough audience.
Well, and it got to the point, you're right, and it got to the point that it really became political. It got to the point that it became who you knew.
Exactly.
For a lot of people. You know, it people like Stephen King amaze me because he's one of those, you know, if the technology had been available when he started, you know, he'd be one of us.
Oh, definitely.
he caught a national, he caught a societal trend. He caught something in society with his writing that plummeted him, you know, skyward. But he, and granted, he's one of the best writers ever, but he writes the same stuff a lot of New Pulp writers write.
Absolutely, yeah, and he's unabashed about his love for that material.
Oh yeah, yeah. He's one of the biggest supporters of pulp in general and that sort of thing. So, you know, is it a genre? Well, no, it's not a genre. And I can argue point after point to show you it's not a genre. And understand, I'm the guy who got into this saying it could be a genre.
Right.
But over the years, pulp's a style. Pulp is how you write a story. To illustrate it, you know, if you look at ProSay's website, we've got books that cross every genre you can imagine. And what I've been telling people is we've got everything you could want on our table at a convention except romance. Well, in about a month that or so, that's going to change because we have our first romance book, To Love and Die, coming out.
Right.
Pulp is multi-genre. There are levels, I guess you could say, to pulp or sub-styles within pulp. You know, this is a discussion that you'll probably have at some point, but people ask me all the time, is noir pulp? Mm-hmm. And I say, not all prose noir is pulp, but there is pulp prose noir. And I can say that with Westerns. I can say that with sci-fi.
Yeah, exactly. Now let's. I want to talk a little bit more about how ProSay started. Like, what was it that made you decide I want to start publishing pulp? Were you looking at guys like Ron and Wildcat Books and Airship 27 and all those, or did you decide on your own?
A little bit of both. Basically, here what happened was in my day job, I made a friend, an attorney, who whose name is Fuller Bumpers, who is the partner, my partner in the company. And Fuller had done some time in L.A. He'd been an actor, an extra, done a few movies, been a writer for the ABC Young Writers Project, and that sort of thing. He'd come back to Arkansas to be an attorney, and but he wanted to stay in production. So he starts a production company, and we figured out we had similar interests, and he brought me in, and we actually started writing audio drama.
Mm-hmm.
And about the time we started writing audio drama and also preparing for comic books and some stage stuff, Going back to Derek Ferguson had encouraged me to submit a story to Airship 27. Mm-hmm. And so I did, got accepted. Ron and I became friends. And as that whole process started, even before the story was actually accepted, Derek putting me in that frame of mind got me to looking at the field, at the new, at the what we would call later the new pulp field. Mm-hmm. And I'd always been a Moonstone fan. I was familiar with Wildcat books. But that was really it until I got into looking at Airship 27 and some of the other publishers that were out there. Age of Adventure was out there at the time, and a handful of others. And one of the things that was missing, and not completely missing, I wasn't aware of it. There were examples of it out there, but there was no longer a pulp magazine.
Right.
So I went to Fuller and I said, we need to get into the pulp magazine business. And we did. We started three magazines, Mask Gun Mystery, Peculiar Adventures, and Fantasy and Fear. And those ran for, we did them in alternating months. And those ran for about 10 months. And about into that, and we started getting all these writers and stuff. And Derek contributed, and Barry Reese contributed. And we brought in new writers, Nancy Hansen, Kevin Rogers, Lee Houston Jr., and some others. Mm-hmm. And I started seeing, even though the magazines, it was a cool thing to do, the magazines were, at that point, really restrictive. We were really the only print magazine. Wildcat was doing Startling Stories, but it was quarterly. And so we stepped off into anthologies and books because we got novels, because we got a lot of people requesting it. And that's really where it sort of took off. It took off so much, and it was really funny because we walked away from the magazines because they weren't making money. But within a year or so of that, people wanted the magazines back so badly that we actually started a single magazine, Prose Presents, which was monthly for a while and is now quarterly. And that's where we get a lot of our writers from. So now we're up to, you know, we've got counting writers, creators, writers, artists, editors. You know, we're closing in on 200 people that are associated with Prose, and most of those on a recurring basis.
Right, right. Yeah, it's amazing how much you guys have grown because, you know, over at Pulpwork, we're just a small operation. It's just me, Joel, Derek, Russ, and Josh. But you guys, I mean, my God, and it's happened so fast, too.
Well, and there's good and bad in that. You know, we get criticized a little bit for that, and I take it. You know, we intentionally have a plan, and mm-hmm. we are at the apex of our plan, and that's where we're going. You know, and one of the things though about this community, because you just mentioned all the guys at Pulpwork, and Every one of the names you mentioned has done or does something for Prose.
Right.
Ron Fortier, the guy behind Airship 27, writes for Prose also. There's this sense of community. I mean, and we're all competitors to a degree, but there's this sense of friendly community that has allowed us to grow, you know. But we are also, even though I talked about not being a traditional publisher, we've tackled it with a sort of a traditional publisher frame of mind because we have, you know, we have a staff of editors. You know, you've edited for us. We have copy editors. We have content editors. We have our director of corporate operations, Morgan Miner. We have a staff of artists. We've tackled organization from a traditional point of view to a degree.
Right, right.
And that's how we've been able to grow so quickly.
Yeah. I mean, looking at the looking at the internal stuff you guys send, like with lists of editors and artists on each title. It's so organized, and looking at it, I'm just like, oh my God, how does he do all this?
He doesn't by himself, and you're part of that process. You're right. An editor. You're one of our best editors. Actually, we get more compliments on you than we do almost anybody else.
Thank you.
Well, we do. I mean, it's true. But there's this process. And have there been starts and fits? You bet. Are we perfect every time? No. But those like you that are involved, have been involved for a while, if you pay attention, you can kind of see what our plan is. You can kind of see where we're going, and
right.
and we're getting there. We've got this set up that, you know, God forbid I get abducted by alien mobsters tomorrow. There's a Pulp story.
Coming soon, Pro Se Presents.
Yeah, exactly. And the company can go on without me.
Right.
You know, it's set up in a structure to where, you know, I know I do a lot and I'm responsible for a lot, but even I can be taken out of it. And if the right things are done, Pro Se can continue. And that's sort of what we've wanted to do. We've wanted to get it in a position to where Fuller has his job, I have my job, and other people have their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Because if other people have jobs, then I can do jobs that other people
exactly.
aren't doing. So that's sort of where it is. And in about we technically got started in August of 2010 with our first publication. So a little over 3 years, this is where we are.
Wow. Yeah. And you've expanded into doing things like the Pulp Arc Awards and the Pulp Arc Convention and that sort of thing as well. Plus, you have two podcasts that you do, about one for Pro Se specifically and one on new pulp in general.
Right. Well, and you mentioned Pulp Arc, and unfortunately, we are no longer doing the convention. This was our last year. One of the great things, we put together an excellent convention, and we put together an excellent convention 3 years in a row. But one of the issues we've had is just getting people through the door. And as much as, you know, we like people to come hang out, and people enjoyed hanging out. As a matter of fact, this year, most of our vendors and guests went home making money. Now, that's cool, but they mostly made money off of each other.
Right.
So we had full panels. We didn't have a whole big bunch of people. Had a great time, and it cost the company. And so a decision was made that, you know, do we want to further the company, or do we want to spend this chunk of money on something that may take us years to develop? And so what we've decided to do is we are foregoing Pulp Arc for a while, at least, if not permanently, putting that money next year and in future years into the company. We are continuing the awards.
That's good.
Yeah, the awards will continue because it is the most comprehensive pulp award out there. We cover 12 categories. We're actually probably going to add a category or two this year. We typically added one each year. So we are the most comprehensive pulp awards out there. So we're going to continue that. But but yeah, I mean, I've sort of stuck my finger into the whole pie, sort of like Jack Horner. And I didn't pull out a plum, I pulled out pulp. So
one of the nice things about what Pro Se is doing also is that you guys, like you mentioned, you kind of operate as a traditional publisher. And that's good for writers who may want to get into it, may want to self-publish, but, you know, their stuff may not have the market for an agent or for the traditional publishing market. But you guys do a lot of the work that a new writer may find too daunting. Like, you know, you have editors, you have proofreaders, you have cover designers and all that kind of stuff.
Well, yeah. And you know, one of the things I was told today, and I took it as a compliment, is that, you know, we have writers who work for us because they don't want to do the work themselves. And that is one of the benefits of a publisher. A publisher offers that opportunity.
Right.
We also offer a sense of belonging. And I know that there are people out there who believe that that's not necessary anymore, that people don't want that. But there are writers who want to belong to a house. There are writers who want an identity. Oh, I work for X. Oh, I'm a Pro Se writer. Oh, I'm an Airship writer. There are writers who
absolutely
want that. And, you know, can you make a mint self-publishing? Yes, you can. Is it the rule that you're going to? No, it's the exception currently, although there are people out there who are doing it. There are publishers like me who are out there. Now, I'm not one of them. Let me clarify.
No.
But there are publishers out there, small publishers, who are hitting that right trend, who are doing whatever and making money hand over fist. You know, we're continuing, but I'm not making anybody, including myself, rich doing this. But there are exceptions to the rule, but there are publishers, there are writers and artists who enjoy the identity of a publisher, and that's what Pro Se provides.
Yeah. And there are some writers, like I, for myself, I kind of like being able to have the control over putting the whole book together on my own. But I know there are other writers who they're just kind of like, I don't want to do all that. Like I know Barry has talked about that on his blog about how he likes being able to have that kind of security where he can just focus on the writing.
Well, you know, and also too, you know, one of the things that helps, and it's taking us a while to do it, but we're getting there, is when you build a brand, and there will be people who listen to this that argue with me as to whether or not a small press publisher, there's a small press publisher in New Pulp that's doing that. I think we are. I hear more and more. I mean, when writers and artists come to you that you grew up reading and say, hey, I want to be a part of a project with you because I've heard about your stuff, then you're building a brand. You know, it's, you know, there we've got writers who have contributed to anthologies. We've got a couple of writers who have been comic book writers in the past who are working with us because they heard about us, not because I went after them. So there is benefit in being with a publisher that will build a brand. And I think our banner carries a lot of weight. Now, does it carry weight? Does it carry enough weight that I'm willing to sit on our laurels? No, because we've only got one laurel. We don't have enough laurels yet. But it pro se now gets people into doors that they couldn't have gotten into on their own. I've heard from several writers who say that people they have submitted to, larger publishers they have submitted to, have looked at it and said, oh, you've written for Prose. And I've been contacted by larger publishers who have said, hey, this guy works for you. He's written for you. He's looking, you know, what do you know about him? We've got a brand. We've got a name. And it may take us years more to build it to where we want it, but there's a benefit of that to some writers.
So let's wrap this up. I know you don't have a whole lot of time today. This episode will probably be dropping in November. So why don't you talk a little bit about some stuff you'd like to promote?
Okay. Wow. Well, if you've paid any attention the last week or so, we're turning out books like we're baking biscuits.
Right.
One of the things that will probably be out by the time this drops is we've also moved into licensed properties. We've got several properties that are licensed. Heroic Publishing, who was a comic publisher of some prominence, independent comic publisher in the 90s and in the 2000s, we've licensed some of their characters. Liberty Girl, created by Dennis Maloney, is going to appear in the first Heroic Publishing Pro Se Productions book. The original miniseries, Liberty Girl The Return, was adapted by Barry Reese. And by the time this drops, it should be out, with also a new story of Liberty Girl by Barry in there. Another character we've licensed, even though Doc Savage is, of course, tightly wound up with Mr. Will Murray. Will has assisted us in licensing a couple of lesser Lester Dent characters, or I don't want to say lesser, but lesser known Lester Dent characters. And that's Lynn Lash and Foster Fade. And those books have been in the works for a while. Some holdups behind the scenes, but both of those should be out by the end of the year. There's all sorts of stuff. Barry Reese has his own imprint, Reese Unlimited. Nancy Hansen, a fantasy author, has her own imprint, Hansen's Way. We've just started a young pulp imprint, Pulp for Kids. We have Pulp Obscura, which takes really rare obscure pulp characters and brings them back to new stories. We're starting a couple of new imprints. Pulp Domain is one that I'm not really ready to reveal what that's about, but we've just got several things in the works.
Okay. Sounds great. And where can people find this stuff?
All right. We are on Facebook at facebook.com/Prose Productions. We have a website that I have gotten a lot of compliments on.
It's really nice looking.
prose-press. It looks like prose-press. That's where they can find us. We're on Twitter. If you ask me what it is, I can't tell you. But
we'll have the
we'll have the link in the show notes, so yeah. You don't have to worry about that.
Yeah. So and I'm on Facebook. I'm fairly approachable on Facebook, so you can find us anywhere. And if you're one of those people, and we've had a handful of writers who are these kind of people, and artists too, if you prefer talking to somebody, my pro se number is 870-834-4022. And as far as I know, I'm the only New Pulp publisher that gives out his phone number.
Well, that's wonderful. Great. Thank you so much, Tommy. It's been wonderful having you on the show, hearing you talk a little bit about New Pulp and about Pro Se Press in general. Thanks again.
Hey, anytime. I appreciate it, and I can't wait to be back on.
Okay, great. All right, this is Perry Constantine, and you've been listening to The Exploding Typewriter. This has been an episode of Exploding Typewriter, Pulp Writers on Writing Pulp. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be sent to typewriter@percivalconstantine.com. Join the conversation on Twitter @explodingtype or use the hashtag #NewPulp. Visit typewriter.percivalconstantine.com for show notes and links where you can find more information about this episode's guest. The theme song for this show, Faster Does It, was created by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com and is used under a Creative Commons license. If you enjoy the show, please support it by posting a review on iTunes and tell your friends. Mm-hmm.